Tom Woods Show, episode 1879.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, a lot of your friends believe that deregulation caused the financial crisis of 2008 just as fervently as they believe that lockdowns are the solution to COVID-19. For the sake of our future, both of these ideas need to be smashed, so check out my free ebook, The Deregulation Boogeyman, over at regulationmyths.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Today we're going to cover a topic that I guess I haven't really covered over the course of all these Tom Woods Show episodes. We did cover it a little bit in one episode of my old podcast with Bob Murphy, Contra Krugman, but it has to do with two schools of free market economics. And of course, if you're a regular listener of the Tom Woods Show, you hear us talk a lot about the so-called Austrian School of Economics. But there's also the Chicago School of Economics, and that is the one Milton Friedman belongs to. Milton Friedman is very well known, and a lot of people, when they think free market economics, they just think Milton Friedman. And some people may think that even to draw a contrast between these two schools is just a whole lot of nitpicking that only libertarians would care about. But there actually are very, very important differences between the two. And that's not to say that no Chicago people have made important contributions. I think Milton Friedman has done a lot of good things. So I'm not disputing that, but I am firmly in the Austrian camp. And in this episode, we're going to go into why and draw these distinctions. And I think you'll see that these are actually important distinctions to be made. And what you're actually going to hear in this episode is a series of recordings I did with Professor Jeff Herbener, who's the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College and maybe one of the smartest people I know, certainly in economics. We recorded these maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and I had them as just for supporters and stuff. But now I want to liberate them and free them up for the whole world because, as I say, I have had a lot of new listeners, and I'm sure the idea of the Austrian school is like Greek to them. So I think it's an opportune moment indeed to free these files and make them available to the world because it's an important conversation and it's good for us to make these distinctions in our minds. So here we go. So you'll hear them concluding and then starting up again and then concluding. That's because they were several separate files. So I hope you enjoy this. Here we go. Well, here we are again with yet another of our mini courses, and this is on a topic that a lot of people have been asking about. What are the differences between the Austrian and Chicago schools? People seem to know something about the difference between the schools with regard to money, although we'll say a brief word about that toward the end of this series, but there are more fundamental differences even than that, and I've brought here one of my favorite people in the world, one of my favorite economists in the world, Jeffrey Herbener, who is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College, which I highly recommend to you, and who teaches economics also at mylibertyclassroom.com. Jeff, I guess we're going to start this session on one of the most fundamental questions of all in economics, if not the most fundamental question, which is the nature of economic law as understood by Chicago people, and as understood by the Austrians, with particular attention paid, no doubt, to the famous methodological article written by Milton Friedman in 1953. Can you take it from here?
Yeah, that's right. Well, thanks, Tom, for doing this show. Well, yeah, let's start with Friedman's 1953 article. Here he writes about how his conception of economic law is that economic laws are empirical hypotheses to be tested. And so they're, in his view, similar to the procedure of the natural sciences and the propositions of the natural sciences. And so let's say the law of demand would just be a hypothesis. Friedman would say we'd go out and gather data on different buyers in different markets and in different times with different goods and see whether or not at lower prices their quantity purchases went up or went down or stayed the same, and then we do some statistical test and either reject or not reject some hypothesis about how when prices are lower, quantity purchases are larger. There's a famous application of this that made the news a few years ago, a study on the minimum wage by a couple of economists named Card and Kruger, where they did this sort of thing, and they found that the demand for labor didn't slope downward to the right. but that when minimum wages were raised, actually more labor was employed. Presumably then, according to Friedman, the law of demand should be rejected, falsified, at least in the labor markets. And economists should just then accept that as a new statement of the law of economics that just so happens in the labor market's demand curve slope upward to the right. Now, it's telling that many of the economists, mainstream economists, did not take that view, but vehemently attacked Card and Krueger and tried to find the mistake that they had made in their analysis, because they all knew in their heart of hearts that there's really a more fundamental economic law at work that cannot be broken or falsified by empirical evidence. And what the Austrians do, of course, is bring that more fundamental body of law to the forefront. And they say that there really are laws of economics that regulate the social order, that regulate the economy, and that these are universally applicable because they stem from the nature of human action itself. And so the law of demand stems just from the economizing activity of human beings. And it's not then an empirical proposition at all, but a proposition about the nature of how people act as human beings. Now, one might also point out that there could be a more moderate position that we could take with respect to the Friedman project of empirical hypothesis testing. One might say that, well, maybe what the neoclassical economists are doing along this Chicago plan is just trying to find empirical regularities in the world. They're not really talking about economic laws at all, but just, you know, are these different data sets correlated? We'll talk about money later, but Friedman might say, you know, if the money supply goes up steadily by 5% per year, then prices would go up steadily by 5% per year, or some other empirical regularity. But of course, if that's what they mean, then they're not really talking about economic laws at all. They're not talking about the same thing, the same body of knowledge that the Austrians would be referring to when we talk about these fixed principles that apply universally in all instances of action that regulate the social order. They're just talking about an entirely different body of knowledge, an entirely different project for economists to do.
But maybe that helps to explain the kind of response you got from Chicago people and mainstream people to the Card and Krueger study. And I note parenthetically that these days it's becoming fashionable for economists to support minimum wage hikes. But even as recently as that Card and Krueger study, you're right, the response was overwhelmingly negative. And Walter Block will pounce on that and say, you see, this goes to show that deep down, these economists, for all their claims that they're engaged in the observation of empirical regularities, the fact is they believe in their gut that there are absolutely true statements that can be made about the economy, and they know that this claim by Card and Krueger flies in the face of that, and so they have to go around looking to see what must be wrong with Card and Krueger, and so this shows that basically they are Austrian praxeologists at heart. But couldn't the answer actually be, though, that the reason that they're convinced that Card and Krueger must be wrong is just that we've observed empirically a certain regularity for so long that their contrary research must be faulty because it runs contrary to our long observation, not because it runs contrary to some absolute statement about the economy that the Austrians might make?
Yeah, I think that's right. Certainly that's plausible and a possible alternative that they might take. Yeah, it's somewhat unlikely, given the intense training in model building and testing, that their reaction to Card and Krueger was, no, really, the whole project that we've devoted our lives to is completely wrong, and that there is some actual body of law that's inviolable and always in operation, even if not empirically manifest, in the working of the economy.
Now, before we go on, Jeff, what is the name of the 1953 article by Friedman?
The article by Friedman has the title "The Methodology of Positive Economics," and it's in a collection of articles. The title of the book is Essays in Positive Economics.
In fact, I think I've been referring to him just as Friedman. So anybody who doesn't know, we're talking about Milton Friedman, of course, the famous Chicago economist. Now, in that article, what does he have to say about model building or hypothetical constructs and the role they might play in economic analysis?
Yeah, right. He gives an example of the sort of model building that he thinks is appropriate in doing economics. He talks about billiard playing, and he says that we can model the action of a billiard player by all sorts of geometric relationships, you know, that he makes this shot by the proper angles and spin of the ball and so on. And we don't really, that would be adequate to explain the outcome without knowing anything about the mentality, the mental judgments, psychology of the billiard player. And so he thinks then that by analogy, this would work in general for human action. We don't really need to know anything about the human person, that he values things and chooses and so on and so forth. We just need to be able to provide a model that would descriptively account for the actions that he takes with respect to their effects. So that he pulls back the cue and angles the ball at a particular point and the cue ball and hits in the eight ball in the corner pocket or whatever he's aiming for. So this particular view, again, is completely unrealistic. And Friedman mentions this, that in the article, that assumptions that we make about these models can be intentionally unrealistic because we're not really interested in, from his viewpoint, in describing or explaining the actual behavior of real human beings, but just in the relationship between the data set that emerge from human action.
Well, how is this different, though, from the Austrian use of a construct like the evenly rotating economy, where you've got an economy where resource availability stays the same, the population stays the same, technological knowledge stays the same. There seems to be, I don't know if you would say there's perfect knowledge in the evenly rotating economy, but there are no profits because it just, you're just in a steady state repetition of over and over doing the same thing. Why is that a superior way, or is that the same thing as what the Chicago people are doing?
Okay, well, when the Austrians use a construction like the ERE, akin to what the neoclassical economists would use with general equilibrium, they're trying to find out something about the real world by contrast. And so the ERE makes the assumption of no uncertainty so that we can see that in a world without uncertainty, when adjustments of all the resources took place, there would still be net income earned by entrepreneurs in production because of interest, because of time preference, but there would be no profit. And so that allows us in the real world to identify the cause of profit as the superior foresight of entrepreneurs in dealing with uncertainty and to separate that out of the actual net income that real entrepreneurs earn in the world from the interest that they earn from advancing funds to their workers, basically lending to them and then earning interest in the time it takes for production and sale of the good.
So in other words, the Austrian use of the ERE says the ERE is unrealistic and it is utterly unlike the economy we have now. It is utterly unlike it because of the radical absence of uncertainty. And because it's utterly unlike it, we can do an indirect proof, or we can have an indirect understanding of how the real world works by studying something that drops out the most salient feature of a real economy.
Yeah, that's right. And what the neoclassical economists do with their general equilibrium model is they say, we're going to use this model to actually predict or understand the real world.
Or even criticize the real world for not living up to the model.
Yeah, exactly. So all sorts of arguments about market failure are based upon this comparing of the model to the real world. The Nirvana fallacy, as it's been called.
All right, let's bring this particular topic to a close. And next time, we'll talk about the cause of economic downturns. Hi, everybody. I'm back with Professor Herbener talking about the Austrian and Chicago schools and what some of the differences are. We talked about the nature of economic law as viewed by both schools in the last session. This time I want to talk about business cycle theory, the cause of economic downturns. Listeners of my daily program, The Tom Woods Show, are familiar, no doubt, with Austrian business cycle theory. If not, you can listen to our episode with David Howden. You can just Google David Howden and Tom Woods Show, and that will come up and you'll learn all about it. Of course, you should be reading my book, Meltdown, for heaven's sake, then you'll learn all about it. But today I want to talk about the contrast with the Chicago school. Now, Jeff, Is there a Chicago theory of the business cycle comparable to the Austrian theory of the business cycle?
Well, that's a good question. We can trace real business cycle theory back to the Chicago foundations in rational expectations and so on. But real business cycle theory was developed by economists who may not associate themselves with the Chicago school itself. The project all began with Robert Lucas's attempt to use the rational expectations assumption to attack Keynesian demand management policies and the aggregate supply, aggregate demand model. And so it all sort of began in this debate with respect to the efficacy of fiscal and monetary policy on the macro economy.
Well, Jeff, before we go on, I'm trying to think of his name now, Roger Garrison. Boy, I'm getting old. Roger Garrison has a book chapter somewhere and a presentation in which he asks, was Milton Friedman a Keynesian? Are the Chicago people Keynesians? What does he mean by that? Is that plausible? What is he saying there?
Yeah, what he's referring to there, of course, is that the Friedman basically accepts the aggregate demand, aggregate supply framework, but he argues in a kind of narrow way about aggregate demand. He says that the most important factor behind changing aggregate demand is the money supply, whereas the Keynesians would say, no, there are many different factors that can change the aggregate spending in the economy or aggregate demand, things like business confidence and optimism and pessimism and so on and so forth, things that Austrians would categorize as changes in the demand for money.
All right, let's go back to the business cycle question more specifically. So how does a Chicago person look at business cycles, and what is the plucking model?
Right. The plucking model is, again, advanced by Friedman. And what he argues is that the economy is actually going along a sustainable trend line during what Austrians would call a boom. If the central bank is inflating the money supply and we have credit expansion, and then for some reason, there's a shock to the economy that pulls economic production down below the trend. And so Friedman doesn't really have a theory, and Chicago economists, of boom and bust, but really just a theory, so to speak, of bust. And again, this is all within a kind of broader aggregate supply, aggregate demand framework, this sort of same framework that the Keynesians would use, where they say there's a trend line of potential GDP growth, and then the economy periodically by shocks on the supply side typically gets pulled down below in production, this potential GDP trend line. And then it has this slow process, difficult period of unemployment and so on, is trying to move the economy back to a full employment where it would be on this potential output trend line once again.
So it's just shocks? That's how they account for why the economy turns down? What was the shock then in 1929? Or was that just a failure of monetary policy in their view?
Yeah, so this is, again, to turn to Friedman again. His view was that this was a failure of the Federal Reserve in not making sure that the bank failures were prevented by providing sufficient liquidity to the banks by doing what Ben Bernanke did in the downturn of 2007. So this is his particular position, that there was no boom in the 1920s, at least not an unsustainable boom in the 1920s. And then when asset prices reversed, and so oftentimes these commentators will recognize that the shock initially comes from financial markets. And, you know, for some unknown reason, asset prices collapse, the stock market collapse, and this collapses the solvency of banks. And then the banks begin to fail. And then Friedman steps in saying that this could have been avoided by sufficiently expansionary Fed policy to save the banks. But it's a very curious mix of things that count as shocks. It, from our perspective, the Austrian perspective, it's really just ad hoc assertions. So this isn't from the Chicago school, but Keynesians like to point to the oil price increases in the mid-1970s as the shock that drove the economy down below its potential and created stagflation. So they're just grasping at straws, really, from the Austrian perspective to try to explain how this deviation can occur, this pulling down or plucking down can occur in the economy. And they totally ignore the role of the Fed in generating a previous boom and lengthening out the capital structure and generating what proved to be malinvestments later on.
Do the Chicago people have as developed a literature on business cycles? Well, as you say, it's not really a cyclical theory they have. It's a theory of busts. But have they written about this to the extent that the Austrians have? Not the same number of articles, but the same proportion of the attention that they pay to the economy. Do they devote the same proportion of their scholarship to understanding the bust that Austrians do on business cycles? It seems like Austrians spend a lot of time on business cycles. Is this just as central to the Chicago outlook, or is it more of a peripheral question?
Yeah, I would say it's an application of their broader modeling framework, within which they tend to assume that expectations are rational. And when they apply this to the issue of the business cycle, they're sort of boxed in as to what kind of explanation they can give of a cycle. Because if expectations are always rational, then markets should be always adjusting efficiently to any, as they would say, endogenous factor. So it must be something exogenous to the economy that was unforeseen that knocks the economy off its potential growth path.
Help me understand something about potential GDP. How do they arrive at a trend line to begin with? Do they just observe the economy over a series of years, say we had such and such amount of growth, we average this out and say this is where the economy should be going under full employment?
If they would proceed in such a reasonable way. No, actually what they do is they have a model, and they use the model to generate estimates of what they think, given the degree of employment actually is in the economy, what it would be if they had what they consider to be full employment in production. But it's a very artificial construct. It has no connection really to the way the world works, you know, as an economy, as an integrated production system. It's just the notion that we've got a certain number of people employed, and if we model the GDP given this level of employment, and then we add, you know, 10% more workers, what would happen then to the potential GDP? They don't account for any sort of adjustment of the capital structure that would occur over time as more people are employed, or the adjustment of prices in markets and the shifting of resources that would occur over time as a market adjusts to new employment patterns or any of the actual real features of the world.
Well, here's what I want you to help me understand, because it seems to me, as a guy who is in the Austrian tradition, that one of the things this seems to miss, unless I'm misunderstanding it, would be the following. Let's suppose we have an artificial boom that's going on for quite some time, and we then have the recession. We get Keynesians who will say, the problem with the recession is that it puts us below potential GDP. During a recession, people are thrown out of work, so they're not productively engaged in any activity. And this is a permanent loss that we're suffering, so we've got to engage in various forms of stimulus to get those people back employed, get the resources back employed, so we can be back on that trend line of potential GDP. But if it's a boom, if it's a Federal Reserve orchestrated boom, which means, from the Austrian perspective, that capital is in an unsustainable configuration, that resources have been put in all these wrong lines of production, then that potential GDP line is a meaningless line anyway, because it assumes that what's going on is sustainable, and that we've got this number, this growth number that seems to be occurring, and all we need to do is manipulate things to keep that going. But what if it physically can't be kept going because it was based on artificial credit creation to begin with? Then it's just a fantasy. It's a phantom. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is just another example of how focusing on aggregate demand and aggregate supply misses the essential character of the market economy, which is we're always making choices and allocating resources from one line of production to another line of production. And as you put it, during the boom under monetary inflation and credit expansion, were malinvesting into lines of activity and production and capital investment that will prove in the future to be unsustainable. And it's at that very point that the economy becomes inefficient, not during the recession, but the economy actually becomes inefficient during the boom.
All right, we're going to bring this conversation to a close. And then next time, we're going to talk about the universality of economic law and how that idea is understood by the Austrians and the Chicago people. The Austrians, of course, view economic law as being universal in the sense that it applies everywhere, at all times and places. It's not something that is vitiated by considerations of culture or anything else. The constraints imposed by scarcity, the inevitability of having to set some things aside when choosing other things, these things don't go away when you change cultures or physical locations. The Chicago people, though, are going to look at things rather differently in terms of how they view the universality of economic law. They mean it in the sense that they can take economic concepts and apply them to the family or apply them to crime and try to view these institutions through an economic lens. Now, that sounds like it might be okay, but there are some flaws with that way of thinking. We'll look at those next time. Welcome back, everybody. I'm here once again with Jeffrey Herbener of Grove City College and LibertyClassroom.com. All you guys listening to this have at least a 60% off coupon for LibertyClassroom.com as supporters of The Tom Woods Show. You have at least that, so make sure and go use it because you can study with this guy we're talking to right now. Right now, we're going to talk about the universal character of economic theory, and we're going to talk in particular about what economist Gary Becker had to say on that subject. Jeff, I turn it over to you.
Okay, well, let me start with the background of this, kind of the history of economic thought, the background to this whole question. The British Classical School, which was the precursor of the neoclassical school, when they developed their economic theory, as Adam Smith and David Ricardo and so on, they tended to think that the systematic analysis can only be done of the businessman because the businessman has an organized approach to his action, and his action is organized around the earning of profit and the avoidance of loss. And so they thought, well, we can do systematic study here. We can assume, we can have a little model and assume that the businessman maximizes profit, and we could verbally describe the maximization process, and then later the neoclassical economists would mathematize this, but it's basically the same approach. And then when the marginalist revolution came along in the late 19th century and the Austrian school emerged out of this revolution, the thrust of it was to integrate this discussion of the businessman and the analysis of the businessman to the action of the consumer. And so what the British classical school had left out of the analysis is, okay, the businessman is producing and earning profit, but what is the actual final end that's being satisfied by the application of the resources that the businessman is using? And the answer, of course, is it's our consumptive demands. And those are just based not upon some sort of function that we're maximizing as consumers, but just based upon our choice, just based upon our valuing one thing more than another, just our ordinal values of preferring one thing to another. And so the Austrians developed then this integrated body of economic theory that explains this entire process, the entire process of the economy, starting logically with the ends, the consumptive ends that are being met by this, and then explains how the means are arranged in a division of labor to satisfy our consumptive end. The neoclassical economists then, Gary Becker in particular, pioneering this, took a different view. They said the way to provide a more general economic application, the application of economic theory more generally, is just to use this model of profit maximizing and apply it directly to all the different actors in social life. So they may not be maximizing profit, but they're maximizing something. And so we get this maximization modeling that was pioneered by in the 20th century by Paul Samuelson and then picked up by Becker and applied to all these traditionally non-economic topics like crime and the family and so on and so forth. So Becker would say the way to universalize economic theory is just to take the functional maximizing paradigm and apply it not to just entrepreneurs and businessmen, but to consumers who maximize their utility, to criminals who, again, might maximize their profit, from criminal activity to families that are maximizing their joint utility and so on and so forth. The Austrians, in contrast to this, recognize that there's a analytical difference between the way that we behave as consumers in choosing what we prefer between alternatives and the way in which the businessman uses economic calculation, profit calculations, and loss calculations. So if we were to have an Austrian application of economic analysis to not, so to speak, non-economic topics, then it would just be this preference framework that we would apply and not the economic calculation of the businessman. That is restricted just to the entrepreneurs in the market who have their decisions completely circumscribed by monetary calculation.
So in other words, they are engaged in the profit and loss calculating, whereas that involves monetary calculation. They think to themselves, they try to anticipate based on their own knowledge and based on their own forecasting ability, what is likely to happen in the future in terms of how they should allocate resources. And then in retrospect, they can go back and look and see if they did well or badly based on whether they turned a profit or not. So you're saying that this is analytically different from the way a criminal thinks or a husband in a family thinks. What's the problem? What are the some of the, we might say, perverse outcomes that come with taking the Becker economic analysis and applying it to the family or applying it to the criminal? What's the big deal? Like, what's the harm in it?
Yeah, well, I'll just mention kind of the trend. I think the most pernicious feature of this is the continued application of this method and how it reconfigures the application of economists in their effort to do their craft. So what we get at the logical end of this, well, at least it seems like this, we hope is the logical end anyway, is something like Freakonomics, where economists turn all of their effort away from the grand questions of society, the grand questions of what are the causes of economic progress so that we can continue to raise the material well-being of people in the world? And what are the causes of the business cycle so that we can eliminate this pernicious phenomena from social life? And they turn their attention just to dwelling on these minute little puzzles of life, you know, why there would be anomalous prices of used cars in different markets, or, you know, is the criminal engaged in careful calculation or in, you know, deciding to rob this bank, or where they have this reductionist view of the way in which a person, the criminal is a person who's engaged in this activity. And as a person, he might just have skewed valuations of things. For example, a very common approach to the criminal that doesn't take this reductionist economic view is that the criminal just basically has high time preference and that he doesn't want to wait to obtain the funds that he can get from a crime. He doesn't take a job because, not because he's incapable of working harder, that he does a calculation and he sees that the present value of his criminal activity will yield him a greater monetary result than peaceful job that he might take in the earning of income. It's because he just wants gratification in the present, and he's unwilling to, you know, engage in the normal kind of lifestyle that those of us who don't have such high time preferences engage in. So it's the same thing. A more unsavory case is the case of rape. And so, you know, again, is this a calculation of maximizing utility that the rapist makes? Or is it just that the more normal kind of explanation of this, he just has this inappropriate value judgment, and he's willing to commit this atrocity for his pleasure.
All right. Next time, we're going to talk about the character and role of asset prices, and we're going to talk about Eugene Fama in particular. So stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody. Once again, I'm here with Professor Jeff Herbener of Grove City College and LibertyClassroom.com. And we want to talk about the role of asset prices and the character of asset prices, because, of course, that played such a key role in the most recent economic downturn that we suffered. And In particular, a Chicago scholar named Eugene Fama has had quite a bit to say on this subject. So, Jeff?
Right. So, Fama's view and the view of the Chicago School on the character of asset prices is that asset prices embody and then convey to people all relevant information that they need to act efficiently in the market, so that all prices are, in a sense, signals to people who are participating in the market that they then respond to in efficiently acting. So all stock prices, for example, perfectly reflect all of the information that people have that's relevant for the calculation of the future discounted value of revenues generated by these investments. Now, the Austrians take issue with this. They argue that, first of all, it's just not possible to think of this process of judgment that people have about prices or about the underlying information, so to speak, that's relevant for their action in some sort of homogeneous or monolithic sense. So different people, different investors in stock, for example, have different judgments as to the future value of a stock as given by its present price. They don't all monolithically agree when the price of Apple Inc. is $102 a share, that that is in fact the correct price to embody all of the discounted value of the future revenues. In fact, speculators or investors disagree on this price being appropriate, and that's why they trade the stock. That's why there's some investors who are buying Apple Inc. at 102 and some other investors who are selling. It's precisely because different people had different expectations. Different people judge the relevance of the information that's shared by everyone differently. And so this is a completely inappropriate way of thinking about asset prices, their nature, and the role that they play in people's actions and in the working of the economy.
Jeff, I think the most controversial aspect, at least from a popular perspective, of that kind of thesis is its application to the question of whether a financial bubble can ever really be said to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if all possible knowledge has already been baked into the cake of whatever the price is, then there can't be a situation where people have systematically overvalued something, because that challenges the whole theory, which is that, to the contrary, all the information that everybody has and all their views of the situation have been built in, and this is what means we can't have financial bubbles. Maybe I'm not explaining it very well.
No, that's exactly right. Every price at every moment in the stock market is efficiently reflecting the actual discounted value of the future revenue stream that would be generated by that investment. And so if the price of some housing construction company firm in 2003 starts going up by 50% per year, then that is in fact correct and sustainable and doesn't represent any sort of asset price bubble, as we would say in the Austrian view. It's been fueled just by the Fed and the fractional reserve banking system creating money out of and credit out of thin air.
Okay, next time we'll get to the subject you've all been waiting for. We'll talk about money next. And we are back with Jeff Herbener of Grove City College and LibertyClassroom.com. And this time I thought we might say something about monetary theory, because this is the area where I think in the popular mind, to the extent people know about the Austrian and Chicago schools, people most readily perceive the differences. So let's talk about what those differences are. Jeff, what would be the obvious differences on monetary theory between Chicago and Austria?
Right. So the Chicago School, following Friedman at least, do their analysis of money in the very old and we'd say primitive fashion from the Austrian perspective of the quantity theory of money. And so they say that if we think about the accounting identity between the amount of money that people spend to buy goods and then the dollar value of the goods that they buy, those two things must be always equal every time somebody buys something. In a market economy, this would be true. And so if we add up all the money that people spend to buy things, it must be equal to the dollar value of the things being bought. And this gives them then the framework within which they do monetary analysis. So they say, if we can add up all of the money that we have in society, and if we multiply all of that money times the average number of times each dollar of that money is spent during the economy, what's called the velocity of money, then that must equal the price level in the economy, the prices, the array of prices of goods multiplied by the array of quantity of goods. So that's the quantity equation they use. And then what Friedman does is he says, if we make assumptions about these four variables, and the particular assumption would be that in the short run, velocity and the quantity of output in the aggregate at least are relatively fixed, or at least they grow at slow and stable rates, then it would follow that any proportionate increase in the money supply would be matched by a proportionate increase in prices. So if the money supply went up 10% and if velocity and output were held fixed, then prices on the right-hand side of the equation would have to also go up 10%. Now, this conception, again, is very primitive and crude. It contains a basic insight that had been known by economists for hundreds of years before Friedman and the monetarists. That there is some sort of basic correlation between increases in the money supply and increases in the prices of goods. But the Austrians have it completely integrated into their general economic theory, the theory of money. So they, from Ludwig von Mises on, have simply applied supply and demand theory, regular supply and demand theory, to the question of money. And so we have money as just a good that's produced in the economy according to its profitability. If we had a market economy, we have entrepreneurs producing gold coins or silver coins, or they'd be choosing some other appropriate commodity that people desired as coinage. And we would have banks producing money, you know, checking account balances as money substitutes. And that these production processes would be subject to profit and loss, just like any production process. And that people would be choosing, you know, what to use as a medium of exchange according to the value that they place upon these different alternatives that are offered by the entrepreneurs. So different people have a different degrees of demand to have money as a good, just like different people have a different demand to have houses as a good, or to have coffee as a good, or whatever it might be. And it's the interplay of people's demands to have money and the stock of money that's been produced in the past that determine the purchasing power of money, or to put it in the Friedmanite way, the price level, the array of prices in the economy. So this is a much more sophisticated and, from the Austrian perspective, a much more adequate theory of money.
And of course, in our course, Austrian Economics Step by Step at libertyclassroom.com, you give a thorough overview of money. And interestingly, in that course, you don't say Austrian very much. You just present it as economics, which is interesting, which is the way Rothbard proceeded, by and large, in Man, Economy, and State. Mm-hmm. Now, Milton Friedman, I note in parentheses, was of the opinion that Greenspan had actually been a pretty good Fed chairman, and he believed that up to when he died. Why do they favor monetary expansion? What role does that play? I mean, I know that they would have a money rule and they want the expansion to be at a regular, predictable rate, but the point is they still do favor the expansion of the money supply.
Right. So their reasoning behind this is that Friedman, in his great work, The Monetary History of the United States, where he and Anna Schwartz did this book-length treatment of money and monetary policy from the Civil War all the way to the 1960s. He, in that work, came to his conclusion about the relationship between depression and deflation from his investigation of the Great Depression. And so in his mind, deflation of prices caused the Great Depression, caused the real production processes to winnow away, caused the problem of unemployment and so on in the real economy. And so for the rest of his career, he was always vehemently against price deflation of any amount. To have stable prices was always a goal of the monetarist. But Friedman added this dimension that wasn't in the earlier monetarists, who also wanted stable prices, that we need to have central bank policy inflating the money stock, because the growth of production that's natural in the market economy over time would otherwise lead to price deflation. And as soon as we had a whiff of price deflation, then the economy would go down the depression path.
Well, and you and I have talked about deflation one time or another, one video or another. I wound up taking some of the material of that video and turning it into an episode of this show. So Tom Woods Show and deflation, we'll bring that up on Google. Well, I'm going to let you run, and I appreciate all your time with us talking about all these different topics. And there are more topics that one could talk about. You talk about monopoly theory, the Chicago people favor antitrust, maybe not as much as some economists do, but they do favor it. And that's a difference with the Austrians. But all this stuff, I think, will give listeners a better grasp on this material. And for that, I'm grateful. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. If you want to learn more about Austrian economics, I actually have a little site with resources for you, and you're never going to run out of things to learn. It's learnaustrianeconomics.com. Simple as that. Learnaustrianeconomics.com. Go check that out if you'd like more, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.